You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
I want to welcome everyone here today. Whit Ayers is definitely coming. He's just stuck in traffic. I'm E.J. Dion. I'm a senior fellow here at Brookings. And there are two unusual things about this event today, at least. The first is that it's unusual to have, at this moment in our political life, two smart people from the opposite parties willing to engage in a real dialogue about the state of the electorate, and who actually, I think, like each other. And the second unusual thing is that a newspaper column has any impact at all. The origins of this event, and this leads up to my thank you to Zoe, come from a column I wrote back on in November of 2015 online. The headline was "Understanding What Makes Trump Supporters So Angry." And I talked about two books, Stan's book, which I'll mention in a moment, and Witt's book about the electorate. And what was striking is that as people who care about data often do, they might have disagreed in their analysis, but they actually felt the data showed many of the same things. And they looked at it from different perspectives, a Democratic pollster in Stan's case, a Republican pollster in Witt's case. And I wrote a dialogue I would like to see between Greenberg and Republican pollster Whit Ayers, who's working for Marco Rubio's political campaign. It would be between Greenberg and Whit Ayers. And I noted that Whit is unstinting in facing up to the profound demographic problems the Republican Party confronts. Those demographic problems are now, in many ways, even more severe in this election, and I say that without prejudging the outcome. And so, lo and behold, Zoe Baird from the Merkel Foundation, who has worked closely with Whit and Stan on some projects about middle-class empowerment and also problems facing middle-class and working-class Americans, call me up and say, let's do that event. So God bless you, Zoe, and thank you so very much. So in the middle of this campaign, we're going to have a conversation that takes into account what two, really three brilliant people saw before the campaign started and what they see now. And so let me just introduce the panel, and I'll introduce Whit in his absence. Zoe has been president of the Markle Foundation, and again, thanks for Markle for supporting today's event. She joined Markle after an amazing career as a prominent lawyer, a public policy expert. At the start of her tenure, as the internet was poised to become mainstream, she and the Markle board redirected its mission to focus on the potential of information technology to address some of the nation's most challenging issues. She's currently leading Rework America, a Markle Foundation initiative of diverse national leaders, including CEOs, university presidents, elected officials, technology experts, and community leaders focused on creating meaningful work and more paths to opportunity. She has had many honors. She has held, there you go, Whit, welcome. I was filibustering something your party is very familiar with. That's my only partisan dig of the day. I couldn't resist. She was appointed by Commerce Secretary Penny Pritzker to be founding co-chair of her Digital Economy Board of Advisors. And without explaining any further, the two of us met at the same time that we were meeting the Queen of England many, many years ago. That's a very funny story, and that was a long time ago. I think I've known Zoe longer than anyone on this panel, which I'm very proud of. Whit is a leading Republican consultant with over 30 years of experience in polling and survey research. My favorite part of Whit's bio, which is not on his formal bio, is he was a teacher for many years before he became a political activist and pollster, he may be one of five teachers in the country who became a Republican political activist.
Let me tell you, teaching eighth grade is the toughest job anybody will ever have.
Yeah, so. Maybe that explains a lot of your views. He is founder and president of North Star Opinion Research, a national public opinion and public affairs research company. His clients, it's a long list, I'll just say a few, Senators Marco Rubio, Lamar Alexander, Bob Corker, Lindsey Graham, Tennessee Governor Bill Haslam, and his other clients include the Boy Scouts of America, the Federalist Society, and the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association. He is also, was this a copy of Stand, Resurgent Republic? Is that fair to say?
That's a very fair thing to say, yes.
With former RNC Chairman Ed Gillespie, he founded Resurgent Republic, a center-right nonprofit which develops and disseminates a steady stream of national polls. Very relevant to today is his book, 2016 and Beyond, How Republicans Can Elect a President in the New America, which was published by Resurgent Republic in 2015. And Donald Trump is following every bit of advice all the way down. That's not true. But
with a 180-degree turn, AJ.
Now, Stan is also a former teacher, a former professor at Yale. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yes. He is a best-selling author, polling advisor to presidents, prime ministers, and CEOs. This is cool. Stan has advised campaigns in Israel, Europe, South Africa, and Latin America. He was a senior pollster for Bill Clinton and Al Gore, Tony Blair, Nelson Mandela. His corporate clients include Boeing and Microsoft. His new book, America Ascendant, A Revolutionary Nation's Path to Addressing Its Deepest Problems and Leading the 21st Century, was published in November also, and it looks at America through a new lens. There are many reasons I like Stan's book. One is that he's actually optimistic about, hopeful about, the long-term trajectory of our country. And I think, personally, I think there's too much gloom around, so I appreciate, and it's plausible, too. It's plausible hope that Stan gives us. He's the founder of Democracy Corps, which was really the first of these outfits that do polling from a point of view in the sense that people are tied to a cause or a party, but that provides incredibly useful public information. And so, in a way, we have not only a friendly duel between Wit and Stan, but a friendly duel between Democracy Corps and Resurgent America. Let me begin by asking Zoe to just set the table here, because the three of you have been, as I mentioned, working together on how to lift up Americans who have sort of fallen behind in the new economy but have a shot at getting ahead. And again, your project is also built on a long-term optimism about the prospects of doing that. So if you could talk about how you got involved, what's a nice person like you doing involved with these political pollsters? And then I want to turn to Stan and Wit to talk about their view of the American electorate at this moment. Zoe, thank you, and thanks again for having this idea.
So I know you're really here because the debate's a week away and you really want to hear from these guys. So let me just give you very briefly some context, because it's really quite relevant to that. About 3 years ago, a number of us, and you can take a look at who the people were, both sides of the aisle, CEOs, tech entrepreneurs, politicians, a whole range of people, came together in Rework America because we were deeply concerned that our democracy, our very democracy, was at stake in the way Americans were feeling because of the radical changes in the economy, changes brought about by both technology and globalization. And I think a lot of what we saw 3 years ago are playing out in this election. And you can see who these people are on the Markle website. And we brought in Stan, Wit, to do a lot of their focus groups, polling. You'll see some of our work mentioned in Stan's book. You'll see on our website and Wit some of the focus group work that they did. But the real concern was that if we couldn't find America's Moment, which is the name of the book that this group did together, so there are actually three books out there you can look at if you really have nothing to do at night before the debate,
But no, on the contrary, if you want to be deeply informed about the future of our country.
There is another book.
There's a fourth, too? Okay. Anyway, we really felt that we have to find this optimistic vision for America, and we grappled with what it would be, because we are in a period right now of the transition from the industrial age to the digital age. America's going through as big a transition now as we did 100 years ago when we moved from the agricultural age to the industrial age. At that time, people moved from farms to cities. They moved from making power by water mills to making power with electricity that went, you know, through wires and created industrialization and mass production. And it was a dramatic transformation. And at that time, we invented the high school. I mean, we invented institutions that didn't exist before. And we're going through that same transformation now, and we're in the transition, and people are feeling it. And our businesses are making radical changes in how they're operating. And individuals are actually making very substantial changes in their lives, and I can get into that more deeply later in terms of how people are changing their own skills. But the government is so far behind, and the recent Pew polls show that the trust in government is 20%. People's view of government's ability to be effective, 20%. So it's not surprising that when you look at the election and people's view of democracy, that it's so negative. But the optimism about the future and people's capacity to participate in the future doesn't have to be negative. So I'll leave it there. We can get into the, you know, political debate and the politics now, but I'm happy to go back more in the questions and talk more about what people are actually doing to engage in the economy.
I just want to say that this event is being broadcast live on Facebook, so welcome to everybody out there on Facebook. And since everybody is pushing books, my paperback of my book, Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to Trump and Beyond, is just out. And Whit Ayers was one of a group of conservatives and Republicans I interviewed for that book, who was extremely helpful to me in sort of laying out his vision, which he did in 2016 and beyond. And you note in the book, Whit, that Republicans have been extremely successful in midterm, which also means state-level elections in the country, but they failed to develop an effective presidential strategy. Since it's on everybody's mind, I'm going to ask you to relate your overall view of the electorate and what's happening to what we might be seeing now at this moment, as Zoe mentioned right before the first debate. And what I'd really like both of you to do is lay out your broad thesis at the beginning, and then we can delve into it. So welcome, Whit. Thank you.
Well, thank you, EJ, and thank you for the opportunity to be with you here at Brookings. And Zoe, thank you for the opportunity to work with Rework America. I have seen tangible and compelling evidence for the critical need for that initiative and for providing greater economic opportunity for a great many Americans. I didn't realize it at the time, but working on Marco Rubio's Senate campaign in 2010, we did some focus groups, and looking back, I could see the origins of the Trump phenomenon in those focus groups. I remember vividly one woman with tears in her eyes who said, you know, we grew up thinking that if we worked hard and played by the rules, everything would work out okay. My husband worked for the same company for 30 years. The company just closed. His job and all the other jobs moved to Mexico, and he's unemployed. I just had my hours cut back from 40 to 20. We're in our mid-50s. We're too young to retire. We're too old to go back to school, and we don't know what we're going to do. And it's that sense of frustration, of anger, of hopelessness that has in many ways created the Trump phenomenon. My client in the presidential campaign, Marco Rubio, tried to address it, tried to talk about retraining and skill training and going back to school and more vocational training and all of that. That's a step, but this is going to be a long process. And it's absolutely critical, I think, as a country that we end up and come up with better answers than we've come up with so far for a lot of these people who've been left behind by not just globalization, but mechanization and the movement to a service economy. It's also critical that my party make the adjustments to the demographic change. And you are not going to hear much of a debate, I don't think, between Stan and me, because we look at the same data and we're rooted in the same reality in many ways. We may interpret it a little differently, but we're rooted in the same reality. And the reality from a political perspective is that every single presidential election since 1996, the proportion of whites in the electorate has declined by 2, 3, or 4 percentage points. So that the last Republican who got elected president, George W. Bush, in 2004, did the best we've ever done among both whites and non-whites. He got 58% of the white vote, 26% of the non-white vote, and won a close election in 2004. The demographics has changed so much that that is a losing hand in 2016, which means you have got to make some serious adjustments. Mitt Romney won a 20 percentage point landslide sweep among whites, 59 to 39. But he lost the election, and it wasn't particularly close, to Barack Obama, because he only got 17% among non-whites. This year, if the Republican gets 17% among non-whites, no better, but as well as Romney did, you've got to get 65% of the white vote in order to get a majority of the popular vote. Now, that's in a two-way race, but that's what it takes, 65%. That's only been done once in the history of exit polling by Ronald Reagan in a 49-state landslide sweep. On the other hand, if you do as well as Romney did among whites, but no better, 59%, you need 30% of the white of the non-white vote, 30%, almost double what Romney got, in order to win a majority of the popular vote. That's the challenge. You mentioned the midterms. The same pattern's going on in the midterms, but the level of white vote is still 2 or 3 points higher. So that in midterms, we've done very well, and then we have fooled ourselves into believing that because we've done well in 2010 or 2014, that presto, this will carry over into a presidential election. It has not, and my party needs to make some adjustments to this reality in order to elect a president in the future.
Thank you so much. Stan, by the way, may have helped invent the phrase work hard and play by the rules when he worked for President Clinton. Why don't you talk about America Ascendant, both your overall thesis about the long term, but what it tells us about now. And as Witt said, in some ways, your analysis of the electorate is you and he are very close in how you're looking at the current electorate.
Yeah, painfully close. And thanks for Witt for the civility and our ability to work together, both in the work for Markle, but also for NPR and other places where we do a bipartisan commentary on the state of the country. I think we're telling the same story, but the story is complicated. It has contradictions to it that play out in this election, because we have kind of like different stories, different narratives going out at different paces. Some of them are resolved, some of them aren't resolved, but all of them are at the middle, at the core, have these revolutionary changes that are changing the country dramatically. We talked about race, which is the most important piece of it, but that's just one of many pieces. That revolutionary changes, disruptive changes, all simultaneously, has to do with increasing foreign population, increasing immigrant population, Hispanic population, increasing number of people that are unmarried. Over half the country are unmarried, and that's increasing. Increasingly a secular country. We now have a quarter of the electorate that will be secular, not have no religion in this election. The millennials are growing apace, exceeding the baby boomers. The population has shifted to the metropolitan area. Huge growth in the cities in the last 5 years, particularly in the dense, core cities. So you've got these massive changes, going on and accelerating. The political stuff is just like the sideshow for the core changes, in the country. And that's why I wrote called the book. America Ascendant, because it does produce a dynamism, both economic and cultural dynamism, that few countries can match. I mean, I work around the globe, as I was pointed out by Yijing, and it's hard to work abroad and not, you know, cheer for America, because people abroad are cheering for America because they see, you know, what we bring into the equation that make us unique and exceptional, and why I think, you know, over time we will emerge, you know, ascendant. But the other piece of this are the contradictions. I mean, as powerful are these forces, these revolutionary changes that are producing progress, that are producing income stagnation and decline, they're producing increased inequality, they're increased poverty in the cities, and increased inequality particularly in the dynamic cities. They're producing ethnic and racial conflict. There's a whole range of problems that are growing in scale, and the country is desperate for change. It's actually the kind of the core argument that, you know, I think sets up for what's happened with Donald Trump, but also, you know, what, you know, happened with Bernie Sanders. The country is watching both the changes and the contradictions and the downside of our progress, and they want bold leaders. They want action. They want people to bring change, big change. And it begins with going after the corrupt politics that keeps the game rigged, and that leads to an openness to reform. And I make the case that is very much like the progressive era, in which we had an industrial revolution, very similar gains in productivity that came out of the industrial revolution to the IT revolution that we have now, but also similar inequality and problems of urbanization that produced a reform movement in reaction to it. And that's happening now. You know, it's happening at the local level, it's happening in states, it's happening in our politics. And I think that's the context that I, you know, try to bring to interpreting this election. And each of the parties, each of the leaders, are each kind of trying to come to terms with that dynamism. So, thanks.
EJ, if I could just mention something about what Stan said about the hopefulness of America, America ascendant. It's interesting that if you look at who's hopeful and who's not, it has very little to do with your objective standing economically, but a lot more to do with your relative standing. That is, the people who are most frustrated are those who have less today than they had yesterday, even though they may be comfortable economically. The people who are most optimistic are frequently those who have less. They're the new immigrants, for example, who really look toward this country as a sea of opportunity where their children are likely to be better off than they are. The people who are most frustrated and angry are those who worry that their kids will not be better off than they are and will not have as many opportunities as they had.
I just want to say one of the most useful concepts I learned in graduate school was the idea of relative deprivation.
Yep.
And that relative deprivation is so often more relevant to politics and people's attitudes than actual deprivation. Not always. Mm-hmm. Before I turn back to Zoe, I want to press each of you on different problems that, if we will, your side of politics faces and what it needs to be done about it. I'll go to Stan first, which is, it seems to me there are two obvious problems facing Democrats. One is this steady loss among white working class voters. Now, some of that is conditioned by the overwhelming support of Republicans among white Southerners. So it's not as bad for Democrats as it looks in the overall numbers, but it's still a problem in places, can be a problem in places like Michigan or Pennsylvania or Ohio. The other problem is turnout in this ascendant electorate that you talk about, because younger people who are very much part of it don't turn out. It will be very hard for Democrats ever to match the African-American turnout that President Obama created. Could you talk about, these are two very different kinds of problems, and maybe you have another problem you want to identify, but can you sort of talk about these two problems? And again, just that you said the campaign is a sideshow, but it's a heck of a sideshow with large consequences. So if you could talk about the impact of these things on, in 50 days from now.
Look, for me, the core problem is the stagnation of incomes over a very long period of time, in which people have come to believe they've got to throw together a bunch of jobs, they got to piece together work, jobs don't pay enough to live on, and that's kind of the central struggle that people are coping with. They also believe that it is almost permanent. That is, that's the way it is. It's been that way. It's going to be that way in the future. And that's the central issue. The growth of the economy does not rise to all boasts. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't produce a generalized prosperity. That's the core problem. And they are angry at leaders who've not addressed the problem. And that includes Democrats, you know, and Republicans. And so while President Obama did miraculous things, rescued the economy and probably the global economy, brought the economy back to recovery, brought the economy back probably to full employment, his economic project was the financial crisis and the economic recovery. He did not address the long-term income stagnation that for most people is much more important. So you can't describe the economy and say it's really doing better except for this problem that the middle class is losing income over a decade and has every prospect of losing it indefinitely. So the core problem is unaddressed by political leaders. It produces that resentment. It allows both a Trump and Sanders to reach those voters. And so those issues are very much alive. And if you look at the Democratic base, you know, the key elements of the Democratic base, from millennials to unmarried women, to minority voters, they're struggling economically. They do not look at this economy as one that is successful, producing rising incomes. And Democrats who speak out on these issues do well. And if you look at, for example, if you look at the poll numbers for Bernie Sanders after the primary, obviously he would have been attacked on other issues, but his average lead was 12 points over Donald Trump. There's clearly a large majority in the country who are open to a Democrat who is making these issues of the economy and what's happening to the middle class, you know, central. And I do think it's an opportunity for Democrats. But it's right at the heart of what the voters are looking for, and it has a lot to do with motivation. That is why, you know, you know, what is my reason to vote? Does politics matter? Is it relevant? And that's relevant to the millennials, and it matters in and off your election on whether you vote. The other piece that's linked into this is the corruption of the political system. People think the politicians are bought and paid for. The system is rigged. That special interests buy their way. As a result, government doesn't write rules that produce an economy that works for all. And it's very hard as incumbents to make reform your central project. You know, but if you look back at the progressive era, the first issue of the progressive era was the link of business and politicians, from bartenders, you know, from what happened in the bars and saloons, to what was happening with the monopolies and the trusts. Big business monopolies were buying politicians, and Woodrow Wilson said the first problem you have to address is the link between money and politics. People think this is a corrupted system. Millennials, above all, believe it's the central problem. And it's hard. These issues are growing, and that's why I think this is a process that's not going to be settled in this year election or off year elections, but it's going to become an increasing part of our politics.
Zoe wanted to come in on Stan, but it must be about the bars and the saloons,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. If I could just comment for a minute, there is a huge missed opportunity right now on this concern about the stagnation of wages, because the growth jobs in this economy for the middle class mm-hmm. are jobs in advanced manufacturing, jobs in IT, jobs that don't require a college degree. And the candidate that gets behind the opportunities for people to get the skills for those jobs and go into those jobs provide higher wages. And those jobs can't be filled. Those are the jobs that take longer to fill in all around the country. Those are the jobs employers are hungry to fill. They're in healthcare. They're in IT across all sectors. We have an effort going in Colorado and in Phoenix called Skillful, where we've done the work with businesses around the state and around Phoenix to look at those jobs and what are the skills that are required, and are working with the community colleges and others who train to those jobs. It's being done all over the country to look at these jobs, and they can't be filled. There are 5.5 million of these jobs. And these jobs are particularly great jobs for women. And as you look at the data on the jobs that women are going into, a lot of these jobs require the social skills where women are doing particularly well in these jobs. They're licensed jobs where women are doing particularly well, for example, in healthcare. So there is a very big missed opportunity for politicians, for government officials in looking at these middle skill jobs where there's income growth potential for the 70% of Americans who don't have a college diploma. And to your point, that income stagnation issue is a huge problem for people on both sides of the aisle, but it's also a huge missed opportunity.
I think Zoe just said that women have more social skills than men, about which there might be some consensus. But thank you for that. I appreciate that. I want to go to Whit and ask you two related questions. Obviously, the focus of your analysis is how badly Republicans have done with African Americans, with Latinos, and also I think the undertold story is how poorly Mitt Romney did among Asian Americans, a group that have, now that's a very complicated group, its composition has changed, but that as a group, they were once sympathetic to Republicans. And so I want you to talk about what the party has done to alienate them and what they could do to change that. But I also want to sharpen it by adding to my basket of questions the basket of deplorables. And we can all stipulate that every presidential candidate should write on their hands, I am a candidate, not a voting analyst. I shouldn't analyze the other side's constituencies. I stipulate that. On the other hand, Hillary Clinton's comment created a very interesting conversation about to what extent is this backlash against her, the Democrats, Obama, actually rooted in racial feeling. I was struck by, I was looking at numbers after that, and an August NBC poll showed that still only 31% of Republicans are sure that President Obama was born in the United States, and you know what the polling numbers show down the line. So I'd like you to address how much is racial and social feeling part of this alienation, because clearly the most alienated voters are older white voters. Some of that's economic, clearly. Some of that's other things, and how that contributes to the problem your party has.
If I can lead into that by keying off where Zoe ended, clearly there are multiple causes of the Trump phenomenon and the motivation to be for Trump. I think the most important is the one that Zoe addressed, that is the lack of economic opportunity, particularly in areas where people are not particularly mobile. I'd like to commend to you a couple of New York Times articles, one by Roger Cohen, who spent some time in Kentucky in the Appalachian coal fields, talking with people, talking about the frustration, the towns that are dying, and the anger that grows out of that. And the other is one by Coral Davenport, who took a look at the transition from the tobacco economy and some of the programs that helped tobacco farmers basically reposition and do something else for a living, and applying that model to coal country, which is really under assault, not just from the EPA, although that's a part of it, but also from competition from natural gas, which is far cheaper now and cleaner, and mechanization where you can mine coal, twice as much coal with half the number of people. And the problem is that if you've been in one of those hollows in Kentucky or West Virginia or anywhere along Appalachia, you've the third generation in the coal industry, getting one of those jobs that Zoe's talking about requires going back to school and probably moving. And that's something that's necessary. There, Coral has a good example of exactly what Zoe's talking about in her article, where by using one of these retraining programs, one of the people in the family went back, became a nurse, and now has a very stable job. But that was one of half a dozen people in that family that did the retraining. So I think the economic angst is the major part of it. EJ, there's no question that frustration with demographic change and wondering about whether you're losing your country, the cultural part of it is a part of it. And I don't think you can deny that. But I think that on top of it all, if you have all of these factors, but you don't have Donald Trump's celebrity and personality, you don't have a Donald Trump. Look at the Donald Trump clones that have been out there running. Against Paul Ryan in the primary, he got 18%. Against Marco Rubio in the Florida primary, Ryan got 16%. The guy who ran against Marco Rubio in the primary got 18% in a Republican primary, running as Donald Trump clones. So it's clearly the personality, it creates this black swan event, the celebrity of Donald Trump. But clearly there are problems of resentment. And part of the reason I wrote the book was to say we need to have an approach that says, as Republicans, we have a country that is fundamentally not aligned with any race, with any religion. We have a country that's fundamentally aligned with a set of values, a set of values in free markets and personal responsibility and leadership in the world and devotion to family, and that those values apply regardless of ethnicity. They know no ethnic boundaries, and a Republican with an expansive view of what this country is about and what it can become will appeal across ethnic groups, and we need to do that in order to be competitive in the new America of 2016.
Now, I want Stan to come in. Also, do we have mics for questions, because this lady right in the front row put her hand up before anyone else. So if we could get her a mic while Stan is talking. I want you to respond to Whit, and mm-hmm. I want to make it pointed by saying that, you know, after the 88 election, you did a lot of work in Macomb County on reaction around race and particularly race mm-hmm. and the Reagan Democrats. And I'm wondering how you read the same question that I threw threw to Whit.
Okay, so let me build on Whit, and because there's a parallel narrative that we really haven't been talking about, which has to do with the way the Republican Party has reacted to the huge revolutions that I've talked about. In my book, I call it a counter-revolution, and that the bigger these trends became, the more intense you had to be to mobilize to try to stop this new majority, you know, from governing. But at the heart of that motivation, if you go back to 2004 when Karl Rove talked about the evangelical voters that didn't vote, was a very conscious decision to battle out on abortion, on faith, and to build on religious motivation in order to have intense support for the Republican Party. But it played out across both parties. The sexual revolution is actually contested in America and almost no place else. And if you want to look at the indicators of what correlates with support for each party, it's abortion. You know, the issue on which the, you know, people are most likely to vote for the Republicans to be on pro-life, and most likely to vote for the Democrats as being on pro-choice. If you look for virtually every new member of Congress on the Democratic side from, you know, over the last 10 years has been pro-choice, and every new Republican has been pro-life. So if you look where the parties are united and where they are, their voters are also voting, it comes around the sexual revolution. And that's also a heart of this. Just so you have this religious faith, you also have this race consciousness and upset with this racial diversity, growing racial diversity of the country. And those two together are big pieces. And what Trump added, that's the piece that surprised me, was that you could make the economic argument in the primary rather than the candidate who was running on religious faith, which I thought would most likely be a Cruz, emerge and form the majority. But Trump stopped us because what he said was that even in the Republican primary, I can run on trade and lost American jobs and putting America first and win in a primary and win over religious voters who will vote on things other than faith. And he blew up the primary and I think became the nominee because he was running on economic issues. I don't think it was just because it was Donald Trump. Maybe because it was Trump, he was able to barrel through on those issues and ignore the issues of, you know, of faith, but he changed the equation on the, you know, Republican side. I worked to have Democrats be a national party, and it meant having support with minority voters, but also with white working class voters. That's, you know, that's where I began my work. And I highlighted the problem at the beginning. It's not, it hasn't changed. You know, the what holds Democrats back in off-year elections, what holds them back, you know, back with this year, is the fact that people are struggling with incomes that don't grow. They're waiting for political leaders going to address those issues. And so that agenda is, you know, is still relevant. Trump showed you can motivate voters in a Republican primary, but it, it takes place within a party that is battling against the racial, the trends on race, sexual revolution, immigration, and those are also in the mix.
Thank you very much. Please, thank you for your heroic efforts to get the mic to the front.
Thank you. I'm Mitzi Wertheim. I'm connected with both MIT Seminar 21 and the Naval Postgraduate School. I think there are, I think first of all, it's unbelievably complex, and we don't educate people to think about complexity anywhere. It's as if we have a box of 1,000 pieces, we throw it into the air, we don't know what the picture looks like, and we don't know how to put it back together. So we'll only take a few of them to talk about. I think jobs worldwide is a crisis issue. It's certainly an international issue. I don't think the jobs that I think are the most important, I guess it's because I'm a woman, is the people who take care of babies from birth through 12th grade, when their educational and emotional neurological networks get created. We do not have a financial system that supports that. I mean, we give money to guys who sit in Wall Street and they get billions, sort of who knows what they do. But they, in San Francisco, if you are doing preschool teaching, second most expensive city in the world, they only earn $32,000 a year. What is wrong with us that we can't look at these constraining systems and do something about it? Where do we get the willpower to do that? And quickly,
I want to get other people
in. I think journalists need to tell stories so the general public can run it. Here's a story in the newest Bloomberg Business Week. I cannot figure these graphics out at all, and I think graphics turn out to be really important. So I worry about our journalists.
Yeah, I do too. We all worry, or journalists worry about our journalists. We're having a big debate among ourselves right now. Two issues there. One is just the child care issue, which actually has emerged in an interesting way in this election, and what that basket of issues, how it, you know, in Zoe's case, I'd like to ask how those kinds of issues affect your analysis of what needs to be done. More generally, why has this campaign been unusually low in real debate on specific questions of the sort we are talking about? And I don't want to be guilty of the false balance I can criticize. I mean, Hillary Clinton has a basket full of webpage proposals on all of this, but they are not at the center of the campaign. So, Zoe, do you want to talk about that as it relates to the work you've done?
Yeah, our work isn't specifically on K-12. It's post-secondary education. But I think in the election itself, there's actually been much more attention to preschool education in K-12 than there has been to post-secondary education and to the issues that we've been talking about here in terms of innovating in the way people are going to get the skills that they need for these growth jobs that are needed in the economy.
And I just think, if I can underscore, one of the reasons I think the question is interesting is because actually childcare jobs are a potential growth job. And as the questioner suggested, they just don't happen to be high-paying jobs, which is curious since raising our kids ought to be the most important thing to us. But anyway, Stan.
So one of the growing contradictions with our progress, along with the inequality, urbanization, is you have more and more kids raised by single parents. You have more and more people living in the cities that are more with people more segregated, increased poverty in cities. And the one of the things that we're not getting at are the very problems you're talking about, is early childhood, you know, dealing with the 1 to 3, early childhood. That's these huge, because the problems are getting worse, the lack of us actually doing these things becomes that much more poignant and also politically relevant. I mean, all the evidence is that when you run on universal preschool, it's immensely popular. Watch it in, you watch in Chicago, watch in New York. It's immensely popular as a political program to begin to address what you're talking about. And I think we shouldn't, as we focus on the federal government, lose track of the fact that a lot of this, maybe most of it, you know, and as it happened in the progressive era, will happen locally and in the states where you can actually move ahead on these things. And there's lots of evidence that people, you know, can move on it, and we can maybe shift resources, you know, to them. Let me mention childcare, because it seems like a narrow issue. It used to be that Republicans had childcare policies, and I was reading, and when doing my book, reading the conservative literature, and some of the conservative academics were noting how come the Republicans don't have childcare policies, you know, in their current platform, even though it was in prior ones. Well, the reason is they're still waging sexual revolution. They still think, you know, the Republican Party still thinks that if you have childcare, you are giving primacy to working women over homemakers, and they haven't settled that issue. That's still an unresolved issue. David Brooks said at one point and said, you know what, Republican Party, when this election over, has got to say we accept the sexual revolution. You can't start to reach millennials, you can't start the progress and reform unless you begin with accepting the sexual revolution, and you can't deal with the modern family and childcare and have policy, inventive policy, unless you get past that and figure out how to have disruptive changes.
30 years ago, I worked for a very fine governor in South Carolina, Governor Carroll Campbell, and he was a creative, conservative, Republican governor. One of the things we did then was create some tax credits for child care so that women who wanted to work could do so. So, I mean, it has a long history in Republican politics, and we can talk about why it hasn't been in the recent platforms, but I think that's more a function of the preferences of the individual candidates than some kind of lack of concern about it. Let me see if I can address EJ's question about why we don't have a great policy debate. I have done some work with the International Republican Institute over the years in second and third world countries. This presidential election reminds me a lot more of a presidential election in a third world country than an advanced industrialized democracy. What do I mean by that? Well, I mean that it is a totally personality-driven election. We have this idea that voters sit there rationally and say, well, I have this set of issue positions on trade or abortion or gay rights or whatever, and I'm going to decide my issue positions, and then I'm going to look out and see which candidate reflects my issue positions best and go for that candidate. We neglect the fact that frequently the arrow goes the other way. That I decide who I like based upon some other factors, particularly a personality, and then I adopt whatever issue positions that particular person has. And in a third world country, it's my big guy versus your big guy, and it's all about the big guy, or in this case, the big guy and the big gal. And it's very personality driven, personality focused, and issues have very little to do with the choice between the two.
There's an upbeat thought. Two voices in the front, and then I'll move back. If you could, both of you, come in. Please keep your questions short, because there's so many people in the room who want to join in.
I'm Steve Barrell from Duke University. Most of your collective economic analysis has ignored the most encouraging set of numbers that's come out of the government, which has to do with the increase in incomes, remarkable gains in incomes, and the reduction in poverty, slightly less. Why?
The family income number.
Thank you. Gentleman, as you all you know, was referring to the recent census report, which was the best news we've had, depending on how you want to look at it, since 2007 or 1999. So thank you very much.
Thanks very much. I'm Garrett Mitchell. I write the Mitchell Report. And I want to I want to come back to the word that Zoe used, which is that this is very much about complexity. And then she followed by saying, you know, the primary issue is the job-related issue. The second is the sort of political stalemate kind of thing. It seems to me that that if what we're dealing with is complexity, each of those issues, job-related, political stalemate-related, are all there. But that what we're really into now, this is a hypothesis, mm-hmm. to see whether the pollsters can set me right, that we are in a place now where we are truly playing three-dimensional chess, if not more. And that the one sort of term I haven't heard but strikes me as being at the heart of what is central to the nature of this particular election and an explanation of why something like a Donald Trump can actually emerge, period, but emerge at the top of his ticket, is a sense of loss, period. L-O-S-S, economically, socially, psychologically, emotionally, et cetera. And I would just say that the two books that I have read recently that underscore that better than anything that I've read is, first of all, the book that Bob Putnam did about a year and a half ago called Our Kids, mm-hmm. and the second is this very interesting book that J.D. Vance just did called Hillbilly Elegy.
Thank you so much. Those two actually go together, those two questions, in interesting ways. And now let's bring the mic to the back so people in the back of the room can get in. Again, please keep your questions short so we can get a lot of people in. On the one hand, we had this good news. Does it penetrate? Does it mean anything? Does it last? Because to me, what was striking about these numbers is the first time in a long time you've seen more growth in income at the bottom than at the top, which was really striking. And yet, I think Gerd's question about sense of loss is really a big deal. Make America great again. The key word is again, which is about some time back there. Whichever of all three of you, really, I'd love you to take those questions.
Okay.
Do you want to start, Zoe, just on the sense of loss and on the job numbers?
Maybe Stan should start. No, and then I'm happy to jump in.
Okay. Let me start with the income gains. And I always begin a little bit cautious on it, and it's real. I mean, we have a gain in 1 year, and I watch, you know, all of the elites rally to it, and it's very important. It's 1 year, and I'm looking at these numbers through real people. When we would give them in focus groups, where we would give them the number of jobs created, and we 8 million jobs created since whatever. You almost had to protect the moderator from being attacked by the people there, because they know that this is a restructured job market. They know they're putting together multiple jobs. They know that the jobs lost pay significantly less than the new jobs created, since the financial crisis. I think I've seen data on the lower end of the spectrum that part of the gains have come from increased hours rather than increased wages. And so my first reaction, it's the same game. Until I see that we're dealing with really sustained gains over a long period and generalized, that it's, it's like, if I throw out to a focus group, I'll bet they'd attack it. Simply because they're, I think, more realistic than the statisticians on what's happening in their lives, what's happened over a long period. They still haven't gained back to where they were, and what's likely to happen in the years ahead. So I think that's the context for interpreting it. It makes me cautious. I also remember Bill Clinton, and in terms of political, just pure politics of it. Bill Clinton ultimately got enormous credit for his economic policies in the 96 election. But he also got punished in 94 when he was also out trying to make the case for his economic policies before people began to feel it. It sometimes takes years. I've watched the Tories lose their election and put billboards up that said Britain's booming and get thrown out on the economy way before people begin to feel it. So politically, I don't think it matters. I think one shouldn't jump on it. But I would care about it if it was sustained. But I think it's much more likely to be interpreted within a, within that structure. I'm going to come back in a second.
Can I just sharpen the thought for you too as you jump in? The sense of loss idea, I have been struck, and other people have as well, that there is a certain nostalgia on the left and the right in our conversation, that the left is nostalgic for an economy where wages were high, unions were strong, and the right is nostalgic for an America where families were strong. One breadwinner could bring home enough for everyone. These two forms of nostalgia are kind of are more interrelated than either left or right want to acknowledge. I just want to add that point because I think the sense of loss point is a real thing that's going on out there.
Yeah, so I want to comment on this. I think this election's going to be really close because the country's really divided on this very question. This is the heart of it. Half the country, whether right or left, half the country is looking back and has a sense of loss and is nostalgic, and half the country feels we can tackle this stuff. This is exciting. I love these tools. I love these toys. I'm taking classes. We have a poll coming out with Pew next week that I can't talk about yet, but it's really exciting. It is amazing to see what people are actually doing, and that's all I can tell you, but it is amazing to see what people are actually doing. It is amazing to see people's attitudes about what is actually helping and hurting. And half the country has a sense of loss and is, as EJ's saying, is nostalgic whether it's right or left for, what they miss. I understand that. But as I was saying about what we're seeing in Colorado, you put in front of, Witt saw this in his focus groups, you put in front of a 40-year-old female FedEx truck driver who's worried that she can't lift the boxes anymore, the opportunity to get a coach at a Goodwill center to find out that she can quickly take a course that does not require a college degree to get into an IT or an advanced manufacturing job that she had no idea she was eligible for, because actually she finds out she actually has IT skills because FedEx is so IT, focused in what she's doing as a truck driver. She's using IT tools every day. She actually has IT skills. And she's thrilled, and she's doing it at night. You ask that focus group, how often do you use the internet to look for another job? And everybody in that focus group, whether they work at Subway or FedEx, raises their hand every night. These people are active. They're engaged. They're looking for the next opportunity. They're not sitting there feeling gloomy about yesterday. And it really is remarkable what's happening in this country. What they're negative about, the 20% in the Pew poll I mentioned, is what they're negative about is the government. What they don't trust is the government. The trust level for Hillary probably has something to do with the fact that people associated with government, people don't trust. It may not have much to do with Hillary at all. I mean, is anyone asking that question? I don't know. But the trust level for government is 20%.
Witt? Just a couple of quick additions to that. First of all, I love your succinct statement that this is all about a sense of loss. That I wish I'd thought of it. I mean, it's really good. And I'd like to add another book to your list there, and that's Charles Murray's great book called Coming Apart, which does a beautiful job of explaining the divergent paths of those with an education and without a college education. But that sense of loss is what's created a relatively close election, which by some measure shouldn't be close. This is an election with two giant opposing forces. One of them is the set of demographic and cultural changes that Stan and I have talked about, which clearly help Hillary Clinton. But the other one is the fact that two-thirds of the people think the country's going the wrong direction. There's a crying desire for change, and people view Donald Trump as a change agent, and they don't view Hillary Clinton, who's been involved with the system for the last 25 years, as a change agent. I think it's a real mistake to assume that Donald Trump's supporters believe all the crazy things he says. They don't. They look at him, though, as a guy who will change and blow up the current system and create some kind of change, and they're desperate for some kind of change. And so it's that dynamic aiding him against this dynamic of the demographic and cultural change aiding Hillary Clinton, which is why this is so close right now.
Let's see, you've got a gentleman there. Again, please keep your comments short because you see all the hands that surround you.
You've been talking about the economic angst that sort of created by the, you know, the creative destruction of capitalism. So I wonder why people who are experiencing this are turning to a party that wishes to expand capitalism. In other words, the pro-capitalist party in the country, if you will, led by a multimillionaire who has spent his life screwing working people. I'm led to think that it may have less to do with economic angst and more to do with cultural angst, more to do with women, the role of women, the role of gays, abortion, things of that sort, rather than the real economic issues. Can we untangle those two things, the economic angst and the cultural angst?
That's a great question. Mm-hmm. The gentleman over here with his hand up again, please be short. A model question, by the way. Thank you. Go ahead.
I'm Elliot Hurwitz, a former State Department and World Bank and intelligence community person. I'd like to ask Mr. Greenberg for some further evidence on his statement about the fact that this is an increasingly secular country.
Oh, thank you,
panel, very much for your great presentation.
I appreciate that. And then this lady over here, and then we'll take all three. Actually, well, let's take one more after you, and then we'll.
Hi, Kristen Cabral from McLean, Virginia. How do we deal with the student debt crisis? How's its polling? And thus, how do we get unstuck the younger generations, which includes my own Gen X? Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And then this gentleman here, right, turn around, right? Yeah, thank you.
Larry Checco. A couple of years ago, Senator Dodd was sitting right in that seat where Stan was sitting, and I asked him if the people on the Hill really understood how angry the populace was. And he gave me some mealy-mouth answer like, oh, of course they understand. I think history has proved them wrong. Mm-hmm. This election, I think, has shell-shocked both parties. Will anything change? You guys know, I assume, most of the key players up there. Is anything going to change as a result of this election?
I think, for the record, Stan's first campaign was for Chris Dodd. Am I wrong about
that's
that?
Correct. No, that's I thought you were doing that for Cassie.
You want to? That's an excellent collection of questions, beginning with the how do we? I think that is the heart of so much. You know, it goes to the sense of loss thing. How do you disentangle the cultural from the economic? I mean, my one sentence on this is: if we had had about 10 or 15 years of income growth from top to bottom, we might not have quite as much anxiety on the cultural issues, but maybe that just means I'm too much of an economic determinist. And also on the secular question, I think is interesting, but take them all and do something with all those good questions. Okay. You don't have to defend Senator Dodd.
Let me start with the secular, but then go to the untangling, the economic and cultural. Because first of all, there's data on the growing the lack of church attendance or across denomination. It's very strong. But there was an article yesterday in the Wall Street Journal. I tried to tweet it, but my app was somehow my iPad was not letting me do it. Kind of amazing story on. And I was watching the decline of community and church attendance and what a mess this is. When I talk about increasing secularism, I don't do it from the point of view of there are values associated with secularism that makes this a better, more tolerant country. I do it in the context that it has all kinds of downsides that come with decline in church attendance. It's particularly true, as we know from Coming Apart, it's particularly true in the working class, where that decline in attendance is most marked. And it's producing communities that really struggle, both on jobs, but not having civil society to buttress people's lives and coping with these problems. So we're dealing with huge problems. Let me deal with the untangling of the issues, because I think we're being a little bit too nice to each other on this.
Oh, good. Thank you, Stan.
Donald Trump. Donald Trump announced his candidacy as the most anti-Obama candidate, and distinguished himself as the most anti-Obama candidate the one most delegitimating, President Obama, who's an African-American president. It's no hidden notion that race was at the heart of it. He launched his campaign on immigrants, Mexican-Americans being rapists and murderers. And so he was very clear that he was making his what's wrong with America, the big change that had to happen, the uncertainty, that had the problem of order. For him, the heart of it was the increasing racial diversity, immigrant diversity. In this primary, which was a white working class primary, it drove away college educated voters, it drove away women. And let's not pretend that this is now just open season. His unfavorability, during the primary went to near 70%, was well over 60 at the end of the primary. The perception of the Republican Party became increasingly negative during the primaries. And so the country didn't love this. The country didn't say this is a version of change. Let's react to the disorder and uncertainty with a new vision. It was a particular brand of the Republican Party, about half the Republican Party, that reacted to it. But it wasn't people outside the Republican Party. He was increasingly alienating the country as he offered his vision. So there's a vision, there's a response to what's happening in the country, and the desire for order, the nostalgia. But for one part of this battle, at the heart of it, is a focus on race and race and immigration and cultural multiculturalism and a reaction to that kind of America. And that's still at the heart of his support. And then we'll get to whether there's going to be change. I'm an optimist in the book because I think the forces are bigger. I also think the Republican Party, and this is going to be a lead-in setup for Whit, to talk about it. I don't think the Republican Party can react to this election with the McConnell statement, we're going to spend every day trying to make sure this next president fails. There's going to be a war within the Republican Party to interpret the election, what should happen now. There's going to be some who are going to cooperate, some not. But I think we're at a different moment. This is a moment.
You are assuming a Hillary Clinton victory in that statement.
No. And so does Whit. So I'll let you talk about the Republican Party after the election and what role it plays in bringing change.
EJ mentioned this book that I wrote a year and a half ago called 2016 and Beyond, How Republicans Can Elect a President in the New America. Not nominate a president in the New America, but elect a president in the New America. And I am convinced, EJ, that Donald Trump got a hold of this book and decided to do the exact opposite on every single recommendation in the book.
That's because he knew you had been a teacher.
Apparently, or something. I don't know. But I mean, he ran exactly the opposite of what's in this book, and it had exactly the reaction that Stan has just articulated in the rest of the country, which is a big part of his problem right now. Quickly, let me address the questions. Can you disentangle the economic and the cultural? No, I don't think you can. I think it's all part and parcel of the same frustration, the same sense of loss, the same desire for something different to occur in this country. The secularism is very clearly going on, and all you need to do is talk to a bunch of millennials. If you don't believe it, they are at the vanguard of a more secular culture. That may change as they get older, as they face some crises in life, but at least at this point, they're far more secular. Student loan debt, the best set of options I've seen came out of my candidate, Marco Rubio. Why? Because he graduated from college with $100,000 in student loan debt, and it was a serious burden. We've done a major survey of millennials. The number one issue they face is student loan debt. It hangs over everything, their ability to get a mortgage, their ability to take any risks, their ability to start a business. And I'd commend you Marco Rubio's package of proposals on that. I think that's probably the best example of how we at least start addressing that question. Will this change? A lot of that depends upon things that haven't happened yet. I don't know that we can answer that question right now. If Donald Trump wins the presidency, I think we have some sort of a realignment along the lines of education, where college-educated people, particularly college-educated women, say, if he's a Republican, I'm not. But you may have more union people on the Democrat side decide that he really is the voice of people who are blue-collar whites. If Hillary Clinton wins, what happens to my party depends upon several things. Is it a narrow loss or a large loss for Trump? If it's a narrow loss, then we set up a circular firing squad. You know, you establishment types, if you just gotten behind him, he'd have won. If it's a large loss, it'll be more difficult for him to make that case. Number two, what does he say if he loses? Does he say the election was rigged? Does he say it was stolen? Does he create this sense that of delegitimizing the Hillary presidency afterwards? And third, does he start a new media company with Roger Ailes at its head to continue the same message that gets injected into the Republican bloodstream? I think once we know the answers to those questions, we'll have a much better idea of whether or not this is going to lead any significant change or not.
Could I ask you a question very specifically, and this comes out of what I sort of the conclusions I came to in my own book, which is that Republicans have a very difficult to solve problem because of the nature of all the people who have left the Republican primary electorate over the last 20 years. One of the striking things to me about the Clinton elections in the 90s is how much hemorrhaging Republicans did in, say, collar counties around Philadelphia, places like that, so that the kind, or where I live in, Montgomery County, which used to elect liberal Republicans like Connie Morella to Congress. And now a lot of people who had been moderate or moderate, even moderately conservative Republicans aren't Republican anymore, so that your primary electorate makes it very hard to bring about some of the changes you want to bring about. What do you make of that core problem that at least that I see Republicans face?
No, it's a major problem. There's no question about it. But it's occurred on both sides, EJ. I mean, where are the Sam Nunns? You know, where are the Dale Bumpers? Where are the Howell Heflins? There aren't a whole lot of people on the Democratic side who are in the middle either. And it's all part of this sorting we've gone through in this country, where now the most liberal Republican is still more conservative than the most conservative Democrat. There's very little room in the middle. And the Blue Dog Democrats that used to provide sort of the balance of power to get something done in the House have all been beaten. And so we have very few, if any,
Mostly by Republicans,
exactly. But it's all part of this sorting where the Democratic Party is now more liberal, the Republican Party is now more conservative, there are fewer people in the middle, which is one reason why it's so hard to get anything done.
But it's not symmetric.
Yeah, that's what I was...
I mean, the percentage of people who call themselves conservative, as you know, is down about 10 points from where it was in 2010. This country is changing. Millennials are driving it as a big piece of it. But the country is changing. It isn't just a polarized left and right. It's left and right in a context where there are fewer conservatives, fewer accept conservative values. And that's part of, I think, the challenge facing the Republican Party. On the Republican Party, 30% in our data, which I know that Whit read, 30% of the Republican base voters were moderates. They were mostly overwhelmingly college graduates. They were overwhelmingly pro-choice on abortion, but had no candidate who was willing to appeal to them. They were illegitimate. Because the sexual revolution is the definition of the two parties for the Republicans, and maybe for the Democrats too, but the country pretty much accepts the sexual revolution, so therefore you don't want to be in that battle trying to roll it back. And it's not a surprise that the contraception was the issue in which they challenged, you know, the Affordable Care Act up to the Supreme Court. So you have moderates who have no candidate speaking to them. And for me, that's where the opportunity comes for change. Will any candidate recognize those moderates who accept gay marriage, who accept abortion, accept a whole variety of issues, want to move on? Will any candidate step up?
And let me just mention quickly, if people may think they mean something different when they say conservative or moderate or liberal, but there are more conservatives voted in the 2012 election, according to exit polls, 35%, than in 1980 when Ronald Reagan was elected, which was 31%, which, of course, has consistently been double-digit more than liberals have voted, 25% in 2012. But you're right, moderate is the biggest group. And the question is, what does that mean and who gets their votes? We've got to do a better job getting their votes if we're going to be competitive.
I want to bring in a couple more people and close, and we'll just go straight across here. Just one sentence on this asymmetric thing. 40% of Democrats roughly call themselves liberals. Two-thirds of Republicans call themselves conservative. It's not, the same thing is not happening in each party. Yes, the parties are sorting, but the Republican Party is a much more conservative party at the grassroots than the Democratic Party is. Please.
Yes, I have a question about polling, but first it's I want to suggest that the word isn't loss, but betrayal, and that Donald Trump pushes the idea that white people have been betrayed, I won't betray you, and he even used it with the black community. So Donald Trump has approached his theory, his election, as a bully, as a strong arm, similar to what you see in foreign countries. And it's working for him. What I'm surprised about in the polling is the degree to which the bullied seem to be acquiescing by not voting, meaning Hispanics don't seem to want to be coming out to vote. Millennials with student loans have a lot to lose, but they're not going to come out to vote. So it's not just about the bullying, but how the bullying is affecting people's not coming to vote.
The lady right next to you.
Lea Feldman, I'm an intern at the German embassy. What do you expect the impact?
We could have a whole conversation on what's happening in German politics.
That is, I'm happy to join.
Many relationships with what's happening here.
Yeah. What do you expect the impact of last weekend's events will be on the election?
Oh, excellent question. This gentleman here, and then this gentleman here, and then I have a closing question.
Thank you very much, Alexander Kravitz. One of the problems with the panel is it's too short. I think we could go on for at least a couple more hours.
Thank you. That's better than the alternative.
just a quick question because of the time. What are you going to be looking for in the debates, since you talked about the debates, that might change or might not change things?
That's excellent. And in fact, and then this gentleman over here, and then we'll close it. And just on the debate question, just sort of bring it over to him. Please, thank you. I know neither of you wants to strategize for Trump, but I would love to see what both of you would say to the question, what does Clinton need to do? What does Trump need to do?
EJ, my question for the panel, it's very short. White married women, how can Hillary Clinton appeal? And I ask that as a member, a proud member of the Women's National Democratic Club. Yes, men can be members.
Thank you. All right, we take, and Zoe, jump in here. You want to start now or go ahead? Because I have a question for you.
All right, let me start with betrayal. The fact that a great many Republicans feel that way, I think you can credit to Ted Cruz. He managed to take anger at Washington and turn it with his talk radio acolytes into anger at Republicans and Republican leaders. And that's when he started using that word is when you started hearing a lot of Republicans using that word, that they feel betrayed by their leaders. But that doesn't deny the fact that you're right, they do, a lot of them do, and that's part of what's driven this anti-establishment desire for change. As far as the impact of the terror attacks goes, I think you have a beautiful example of totally different, diametrically opposed ways of going about it, where Hillary Clinton says the law-abiding American Muslim community is our first line of defense, and Donald Trump declares war on Muslims. So you paid your money and you take your choice, but we've got a very clear and vivid difference of how you go about dealing with that. As far as the debates go, I have no earthly idea. I'm pretty well assured what Hillary will show up. You know, which Hillary will show up. I've got a pretty good idea of how she'll come across. I've got no clue which Donald Trump will show up, which is why I think we're going to have the biggest audience we've ever had next Monday night. I mean, this could approach Super Bowl levels because of the curiosity to see which Donald Trump's going to show up and what he's going to say.
Except we won't have anybody throwing too many flags, which might be helpful in this particular debate. Go ahead.
Let me start with betrayal, because I do that is the accusation that the leaders of the Republican Party have betrayed them and betrayed Republican voters. That was true. It's in my book, before which came out before Donald Trump ascended, and that is with my focus groups, with Republican-based voters. They believe, the great majority of them believe, and it showed up in the exit poll, that their leaders failed to stop Obama. That's the core issue. Obama represents the new American majority, being an African-American president above all. They think he took them to the cleaners. He acts by executive order. He's winning. And they think their leaders who went there to stop him betrayed the base because they failed to stop him. So it's a powerful concept, and it's a thing that he, I think, took ownership more than anyone else, Cruz too. In fact, the two of them are kind of competing for running. But that's the majority position. But it also goes to the fact that the African-American president. We did elect an African-American president twice, and a lot of white working-class voters voted for that African-American president. Let's get rid of Appalachia. Let's get rid of the South. Let's get rid of the plain states and rural areas. If you look at the East, West, and
Democratic pollster proposes cutting Appalachia off from the country.
I'm for that. If you take the industrial part of the country, it's something like about 45% of working class whites voted for Obama. I did focus groups in Macomb County, right before the 2008 election, and tried to explore: are they really going to vote for this African-American president? What criteria was it? They want to know whether he was going to govern, for his own people or whether govern for the country. And they decided they broke for him. And Macomb County, he won Macomb County in 2008. And let's remember this country. It's not the one that Donald Trump is describing. It has betrayed those who are fighting. A majority of Americans approve of Barack Obama's as president, a majority voted for him, and there's a large part of the white working class that did too. And so there is when I look at the challenges we face, I don't assume racial polarization, conflict. We need to recognize that this is a changed country. We're talking about a counter-reaction against it. Betrayal is part of it. But part of what it's produced, and I'll end with that in order not to speak too long, is the reaction of people to the negative tone, the bullying, that you think may lead millennials, Hispanics, to not vote. Now, they may not trust. The trust level, for Hillary may not be as high as for President Obama. But that's not what I hear when I listen to them. They think the stakes of this election are enormous. African-American voters think that if Trump gets in, the entire legacy, all the work that elected, the history of their parents, that entire history is squandered. Hispanic voters think the stakes are enormous in terms of voting. It doesn't mean they're as warm about Hillary, and it may be pollsters are asking the wrong question. But there's no doubt that negativity has led people to want to turn it off. But then on the other hand, they're probably going to turn it out in the biggest numbers possible for the debates.
Let me close with a question to you, Zoe, because I have a hope and I have a fear. Stipulate for this question that Trump doesn't win. If he does win, I don't know what. I don't think any of us has any idea what that looks like, but some of us have real fears of what it might look like. But let's stipulate that she wins. There's a sliver of the hopeful side of me that says there is actually a big discussion in the Republican Party. We can't repeat what we did the last 4 years. I see an awful lot of the politics in the party, particularly at the federal level, going in the direction of Hillary can only last 4 years. The next election is ours. We're going to take the Senate back, even if we lose it this time, which is not clear yet. So we can sort of appease the Trump voters by putting up a wall of resistance to Hillary, and then we can move on. In the state level, you have, and Witt, I'll stipulate because Witt will want to say it, all his clients are really good on this stuff, but there, on the, some states you have Republicans who actually have worked with Democrats on some of the issues that you're talking about. In other states, you've had sort of exactly the same kind of ideological politics you've had in Washington. You will be offering a series of ideas on how to answer some of the discontents we've talked about for 2 hours. What do you see happening after this whole thing is over, after we make our exodus from this campaign to something we hope is, if not a promised land, better than the thing we're in right now? What do you see happening?
Well, I think we have a great opportunity, perhaps regardless who wins, to pause and recognize that we need to create a digital economy government that will enable our government to catch up to where the private sector is, to capitalize on working with the private sector, to meet the expectations of the public, and that the government has to be part of making this transition to the digital age. If we don't do that, the government is going to become very irrelevant in people's lives. People will move on their own. The private sector will move ahead without the government. The private sector is already, in many respects, negotiating directly with foreign governments in ways we've never seen before. And the problems we're talking about now and the kind of leadership we're going to be seeing taking over government roles will be very different than anything we've seen before if we don't get ahead of this. So I think we really have a critical moment where the government is going to have to make this transition to grow digital economy jobs, prepare people for the jobs of the future, operate completely differently, and catch up to the digital age. And that's going to be one of the biggest challenges for the new president, no matter who that president is. But I'm very optimistic we can do that. I think there actually are many people of good intent who are deeply patriotic, like Stan and Witt, and I think we can do this, and that things can settle down after this election, that a lot of people are going to be searching their souls for what they did wrong, and that whoever wins is going to be looking for allies and not just pounding their chest, and that we have a great opportunity.
I want to close with a line that I liked that President Obama used that can give us some hope on this. He gave a great commencement address at Howard University, and he acknowledged the problems America had historically, but the line was, America is not some fragile thing. And I like to hope that that's right and that we can survive this current period and that we can endure. And I really appreciate the conversation we've had today and some really, and that includes all of you who have joined us. And maybe we could reconvene this discussion after the election is over and we can have a great discussion of what happened and where we go from here. Thank you.
Thank you.